The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast, where we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me, fresh off the Car Dealer Live stage, he's a very tired and slightly broken-looking James Baggett. James, how are you?
I've got a little bit of a dodgy throat, John, so you have to excuse me if I sound terrible today, but I've just had a locket, and I'm hoping that will kick in the next 5 minutes.
Just the one. Lovely. The Don't one. Overdo yeah. it.
Thank you. Yeah. How are you? You okay?
I'm good. Yeah, I haven't had a lot of sleep in the last 72 hours, but I'm here now, I think, unless it's a dream. So.
Well, it was obviously because we had Car Dealer Live yesterday, which we've been talking about quite a lot over the last few months, haven't we? Which was a brilliant day, and I'm sure we'll cover lots of it during the podcast, but I really enjoyed it. It was nice to get so many people in the industry together in one room talking about what's happened over the last year and what's going to happen in the future. And I just felt a real sense of community yesterday. It was just not like... It was a very social event as well. There was we built in lots of breaks on purpose so people could chat and just see each other face to face. And lots of people came up to me. Lots of people, John, funnily enough, who watched our AI videos and said how much they'd enjoyed that project and enjoyed following it. And actually quite a few of the dealers were there as a result of seeing those videos and following us off the back of it. And it was just nice to chat to them about how they set up their businesses. There was quite a few new dealers there. I just loved it. It was really nice to see people. And then obviously we had some fantastic stuff on the stage, which I'm sure we'll get to shortly.
Absolutely. I mean, that is my regret of the day, is that I didn't have a lot of time to actually wander around and see anyone.
Because you were at the back, weren't you?
I was hidden away with my air traffic control mic on, making sure the live stream worked and everything. But yes, someone did approach me while I was washing my hands in the bathrooms. Someone approached me and said, "Oh, I've watched your video and da da da, and it's you beat James on his AI and etc."
Did they say, "Don't you normally wear a hat?"
I'm amazed you recognize me, to be honest, based on that. But anyway, shall I introduce our guest and get?
Yeah, please, let's do that.
Lovely. So our guest this week, I'm thrilled to say, is COO of Auto Trader. It's Catherine Fairs. Catherine, lovely to have you on.
Morning, John. Morning, James. Thanks for having me.
Morning. Nice to see you. Fresh off the stage from yesterday, of course. We might as well talk about that straight away, I think. I mean, like you were on stage with Joanne Smith, weren't you, from Wink Cars, one of our Used Car Awards highly commended new dealers. All female panel on International Women's Day. Day before International Women's Day. One of the things I thought that really struck me was that quite a bit of diversity, wasn't there, this year on the panels? We had lots of females up there giving their opinions on the industry. And your one in particular was really interesting. I thought, because of the data that you had, and also because we had a brand new dealer who's very, very new to this industry and gave a very fresh take, didn't she, on the stuff that you were presenting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, hats off to you and the team, because you did a great job of showcasing some of the brilliant female talent that is out there in the industry. And not everyone does that. And we've still got a long way to go to shine a spotlight on all the brilliant women out there making great things happen in automotive. And I hope and I think some of those voices will only grow and become more important and more powerful in the future. The more we talk about that future, and the more we come back to people buying from people, retailing being about, the personal service, the personal experience that retailers can provide, I think the more that women and the role of women in that journey will become important. But yeah, hugely, came away hugely energized and hugely inspired by all of the women on stage, but Jo in particular. It was a real pleasure to have her up there with me and to hear her very open, very authentic points of view on our data. And our data is always at 10,000 feet. It's that overall view of the market. And she brought that very personal, very very micro view, which was really powerful.
Yeah, it certainly was. And I think one of her quotes was, she uses the data because she doesn't want to end up, she wants to be a car dealer and not a museum. I just thought that was absolutely fantastic, wasn't it? It just showed that she genuinely does look at the information that you provide and uses it when she's sourcing cars and selling cars, didn't she?
That was my quote of the day. And me and the team were immediately sharing that round Autotrader going like, this is what we do. This is what we're doing. And it's so powerful when, and so rewarding when you hear a retailer on stage, hugely successful, innovative retailer talking about how critical our data is and data is generally to their decision making. And the fact that we were in a museum when she made that quote was even more powerful.
What about the other sessions of the day, Catherine? Was there any that really stuck out for you and why?
My overwhelming sense from all of the panels was just what an incredible industry. Like the passion and the confidence that people have. Like, we're not short of opinions, are we? We're not short of points of view. And you having a conversation, a chat with a guest and really getting to really getting them actually hugely animated, hugely passionate about big things that they were either struggling with or they were trying to change. And the great thing that came across for me as well was just what an entrepreneurial industry. The level of confidence that despite, like, there's not much in automotive at the moment that isn't changing, but yet the confidence and the enthusiasm to which people were talking to the future and looking to the future just made me come away really excited actually about the future of the industry being really bright and the future of the industry having lots more female voices in it too.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lot of honesty, wasn't there, as well, during the day? I mean, we asked people, all of the dealers on the panels, how last year was. And, you know, a lot of them were explaining quite how painful it had been. You know, those big drops in value for EV prices. We had Estelle Miller there from EV Experts, who was explaining just how painful that was for her business. Very, very honest about it. And then even the bigger dealers, you know, the franchise dealers and the used car groups, they were explaining how painful that drop in prices was from the trade price at the end of last year. But what I took from that is, yes, last year was hard, but there was a lot of positivity, wasn't there, for this first quarter and for the rest of the year?
Yeah, Estelle and Sue in particular, weren't they? Sue on the franchise panel were just, they led the way, didn't they, really, with just very open, frank feedback on moments that had been really tough and quite how tough they had been and hard decisions that they'd had to make and navigate. But both of them, Sue, I guess, mostly around volume and strength of consumer demand in the first part of this year, and Estelle around the future for EVs, both of them, like, sitting back, very reflective on how hard it had been, but equally, like, they'd clearly taken a lot from those experiences and were using those experiences to then build, have confidence, place the right bets, might make the right decisions to then navigate the next few months, where it felt like they could both see lots of opportunity in different ways and in different segments of the market. But I didn't get the sense that anyone was sort of sitting there, you know, almost paralyzed by the level of change or looking back going, oh, it's been really hard. It's going to keep being hard. It's almost like, yeah, it's been really hard, but I'm cracking on. I'm moving on. I see the opportunity. I'm going to get stuck in and have another go.
Yeah. And talking of opportunities, one of the things that you spoke about, and it was a stat that really stuck out for me, and we talked about it on the stage, was that speed of sale of used electric vehicles at the moment, 10 days faster than on average than ICE vehicles, petrol and diesel vehicles. I thought that was really stark. It really brought it home to me. You know, as part of our project, we haven't dabbled in any electric vehicles at the moment, as much as John wants me to buy them. We will try, John. But we haven't done it yet. But those stats really kind of hit home with me that we should probably give it a go. I mean, perhaps you could just kind of explain that bit of data in a little bit more detail for those people listening.
Sure. So About this time last year, actually, we saw in January and February, didn't we, two successive Tevza price drops for Model 3 and actually across their model range, and we saw volume of used electric vehicles coming to market. And around this time last year, the demand from consumers just wasn't keeping up with that supply. So we did see, which Estelle talked to actually, some relatively significant price corrections, which for some dealers were incredibly painful. But those price corrections mean that now, and there were some great examples of this quoted yesterday actually, for the majority of electric vehicle make models, like the price position is now at parity, if not very close to parity, with their ICE equivalents. And actually what's fascinating for us is that, you know, you ask consumers all sorts of questions about the buying journey and you get the feedback from all of this research, and we speak to 25,000 car buyers each year, and you sort of assume that people will do what they tell you that they're going to do. And actually this is one of those fascinating moments where consumers tell you that they're prepared to pay a green premium. They tell you that, you know, they're very committed to buying EV. And then this time last year, we just weren't seeing that in terms of the demand coming through. But actually the moment you get to price parity, suddenly consumers are prepared to actually get over that charging hump or take a view on, you know, the risks of being caught out with, you know, charger not working or not having the infrastructure there. They're prepared to take a view if the price point is right. And we've absolutely seen that in the used EV market for the last 9 months or so. And they've very consistently been the best performing vehicle, speed of sale, currently 10 days faster, but it's been tracking a significant number of days faster for a while now. And consumer demand is there. Consumers are ready for those used EVs to make the switch where the price point's right.
I wonder whether, we talked about this yesterday, but I just want to mention it again, that the fact that used car dealers at the moment are a little bit scared after what happened last year with the pricing. And I just wonder whether there is a little bit more trepidation on selling these vehicles because they don't quite understand them. And, you know, I will freely admit that I wouldn't find them as easy to sell because I don't know absolutely everything about them. Whereas I, you know, with a petrol or diesel car, I'm pretty confident on understanding how that works. It's, you know, the charging, you have to give people advice on home charging. You have to give people advice on public charging. You have to give people advice on how quick stuff is going to charge. You have to give people advice on how long the battery is going to last. And I will freely admit, I'm not confident in that. And that has held me back a little bit. Do you think I'm not alone in that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, when we asked our independent retailers last year how many of them had stocked an EV, sold an electric vehicle, still 80-odd% of them hadn't yet at all. And we are this year going to see 17% of 1 to 3 year old vehicles are going to be electric vehicles. So almost 1 in 5 now. So for most retailers, it's going to be hard to keep ignoring them. They are going to be there, and they're going to be part of the mix. Joe yesterday echoed much of what you just said. She's like, well, sold a couple of hybrid vehicles, but for electric, like if something goes wrong, the aftercare, you know, I want to know that I'm delivering a really good customer service and support, not just in the moment, but, you know, through the life of that vehicle for that consumer. And if I don't really understand what I'm selling or know how I would deal with some of these issues, then I'm just not ready yet. And there is this huge information gap still, not just for retailers, but for consumers as well, on like, what are the different decision points you have to make and how do you navigate those? Now, I actually take a huge amount of comfort from that, because back to that omnichannel retailing conversation we were having yesterday, well, arguably the role of the retailer has never been more important, because where else can you go as a consumer? This is a huge product and technology switch that we're expecting consumers to go on. You're buying a fundamentally different product, and consumers need help navigating that journey. They need support. And we can do a good job through digital tools and digital content, but because it is such a significant purchase, people want support from other people, support, help to go on that journey. And retailers have such an important role to play there, that I think it's actually really exciting as well as challenging for retailers and for the industry to get to collectively get our heads around. But we're working really hard to create content that can be distributed, that retailers can use, that consumers can use to help with this journey. But it is a huge transition that we're expecting an industry and consumers to go on. I don't think it's easy because it's just another car in one sense, but it's really not. It's a totally different product.
One of the eye-opening things for me on that point of view was when Estelle Miller from EV Experts was on the stage. Firstly, she is like she's in a kind of parallel universe in her dealership, because they don't know anything about ICE cars. They don't want to sell any ICE cars because from their point of view, they feel how most dealers feel about EVs from the point of view of, I don't understand really what to do if this goes wrong or what to look for and so on. And the other thing was the sheer number of questions that were coming in from, you know, we had a Q&A thing, which the audience could write in with questions. I mean, Estelle was becoming like a kind of agony aunt for EVs by the end of it. It was, how do I know kind of, you know, which models are best for battery health? Which ones are going to last the longest? Various questions along those lines, all quite technical things that actually I forget that this is all stuff we have to learn in the industry. It's all a new thing.
Yeah. I think we're going to probably cover a lot of this in our stories, John. Maybe we should move on.
Okay. So James and I are going to run through our favorite stories of the week. And at the end, Catherine gets to decide who chose the best ones and who is the winner. James won last week, if I serves me correctly. So I know exactly what you're going to start with, James. So off you go.
Let's get the kazoo out.
There you go.
There we go. Because quite possibly the bombshell news of the week was that Cazoo are going to halt used car sales and plan to take on Auto Trader, my words, not theirs, as an advertising marketplace. So this was a story that broke on our travel day up to Car Dealer Live, wasn't it? So I had to turn around, go home and write the story. Thank you very much to Cazoo for that one. It's obviously gone crazy on our website. It's been the most popular one because what they've decided to do is, in an attempt to save money, they are now going to stop selling cars completely. Very unfortunately, this is going to mean more job cuts. We know last year they made a huge swathe of redundancies when they were shutting down large areas of their business, from their prep centres to their used car handover sites. This is now going to affect their e-commerce technology platform team, their proprietary data team, brand, digital marketing and commercial functions. I've had a number of emails from staff saying that, well, quite a few of them found out the news from our website, and a lot of them are very, very worried about their future. So our thoughts go out to them for that. Also, CEO Paul Whitehead, who was appointed to the role in April 2023, is going to be stepping down at the end of March. Obviously, this follows the founder, CEO Alex Chesterman, departing from the company in December. I mean, this is a huge turnaround for this business. I mean, it is a massive U-turn. And I think the most interesting thing here is they have been slagging off this industry since they arrived on the scene. They have been giving used car dealers jip about being sharp-elbowed salesmen, their words, and that the traditional method of selling cars was, in quotes, flawed on every level. And now here they are going cap in hand to every used car dealer, 13,000 dealers across the country, saying, actually, would you like to advertise your cars on our website? Interestingly, some people, I think it was Peter Wardell, wasn't it, yesterday, asked the audience whether any of them would be advertising their cars on Cazoo, and we didn't have one hand raised. I personally think this is a very, very difficult time for Cazoo, and I wouldn't be surprised if this is the beginning of the end. I can't see it working. I can't see used car dealers going there and advertising their stock on their platform when they've got lots of opportunities to do that elsewhere, most notably on Catherine's website, Auto Trader. So I think this is, the beginning of the end, John, I think. I don't know, what's your take?
I've just found it really sad, to be honest, because I mean, you know, obviously, Cazoo is a big source of your stories, James.
Sure is.
Yeah, but it's, and when we talk about Kazil, I think we have to be really careful not to talk about Alex Chesterman and his words in a Sunday paper to represent the views of the entire company and the people that work in it in a way, because, you know, there's a lot of very talented people working in that company, lovely people who are now going to be not working for that company because it's changed direction completely, as you said. Going to the model of selling cars online as a marketplace, I don't think they're going to find that easy either, to be honest. I can see their logic is that they've invested a lot in end-to-end buying stuff. You know, you can buy your car online from Cazoo, can't you? And perhaps what they're thinking is, well, we've got all this technology embedded, we can offer that facility to other dealers. I think they are going to have a big shock when it actually trying to integrate that with dealers that are not within their buildings and are other in other bits of the country. When that actually comes into play, I think it's going to be very difficult for them. I would echo what David Kendrick says at the bottom, which is that he wouldn't be surprised if very shortly that brand is just purchased by somebody. I don't think this isn't a serious suggestion of what their future is going to be. I think it's a slight panic play.
And if they have got one thing, it is a strong brand. They have spent a huge amount.
Well, they won't have for much longer.
But they have spent a lot of money building that up, haven't they? So it resonates with consumers. I mean, if you ask any, pretty much most men on the street, you know, what they think of what is Cazoo, they'll say it's a used car dealership. So,
Catherine, I hate to put you on the spot and ask you what you thought of this, but
well done, John.
What did you think?
Not at all. I think it's felt inevitable for some time, right? They were quite clearly running out of cash, so they had to do something. The current situation wasn't sustainable. And if cash is the priority, then unwinding the stock, bringing it back to the assets that are still of value and that aren't hugely capital intensive, don't need lots more money, makes a lot of sense as a step. So I'm not surprised they brought it back to the brand, the capability that they have. I agree with you, John, that it is like whenever the industry is in the headlines for the wrong reasons, and this is the wrong reasons, right? People getting made redundant, a retailer that hasn't managed to find a long-term sustaining operating model. I don't think that helps any of us, actually. And it's very sad, clearly, for the people there. The thing that gives me hope on the people is that lots of people talked yesterday to talent being their biggest worry or their biggest priority. So you've got to hope that those people pretty quickly are redeployed to some of those businesses that perhaps were talking about this yesterday. In terms of what it means for us and the industry more broadly, I think we've learned over many years of experience that it takes a lot of investment, a lot of hard work over many, many years, not just to build a brand, but to sustain a brand, to evolve your marketplace proposition. And I feel actually starting from the position they're starting from, it's not that they can't make it work or can't make it happen. I just think it's hard, and it's not without a need for investment or capital, different form clearly from buying cars and buying stock, but you need stability, you need a great tech team, you need a big brand that you keep investing in. You need lots of capabilities that they're going to have to build on and rebuild from scratch. So it feels like a long journey for them to win the trust of dealers and to make the investment required to really make a success of that. I'm inclined to agree with you as well, John, that I think probably they're lining up the assets that people could buy and actually selling off the stock, you know, slimming down the operation to, you know, right size the operation for a business with some assets in it that could then get bought. It feels like this is perhaps a step towards that being the outcome. So I'm sure this isn't the last that we will hear of this story over the next few weeks.
No, I agree with you on that. Well, one of the things I just wanted to pick up on that is you mentioned yesterday about omnichannel, didn't you? And actually, we talked about how the online only sales model was sort of phased out. I think your words were it's dead, I think. Could we just talk a little bit about that and what you think this news means to that online only used car sales?
I think I said that omnichannel had killed online.
That was it, yeah.
Maybe a bit controversial, but I think we've seen over the last few years that consumers every time we ask them the behaviors that we see from them, absolutely value an in-person part of the experience and the journey in buying a car. A car is not like buying a book or makeup or cosmetics or whatever else people very, very easily, very comfortably buy online very frequently. It's the second most expensive purchase people make. We've got huge technology shifts, loads of new entrant brands. We've got a product set and a brand set that people don't know well and that they don't understand well. Therefore, the role of a physical retailer in that journey is arguably more important than it's ever been. And not that digital doesn't matter. I think the challenge that I highlighted yesterday is buyers kind of want it all, right? They want everything. They expect retailers to have this very curated, brilliant digital experience with parts of the buying journey able to be supported online. And then they expect to have, you know, personal human experiences on a forecourt or, you know, in a physical space as well. And that's the challenge that we're solving for through our products. And that's the challenge when we speak to most retailers that they're trying to solve for too. So I think this is just, I don't feel like it's kind of a seismic shift in that moment. I think it's just another step on the journey that we've been on actually for a couple of years in terms of the evolution of the industry from one that was perhaps more dominated by the physical experience to one that shifted more online during COVID. And then it's kind of found its new normal or the right one, I think, for car retailing in the last couple of years.
Yeah, well, I think that what you said there will please a huge number of people out there, because it's what they've said all along, isn't it? We can do what Cazoo do, but we've also got the opportunity of being able to welcome those people into our dealerships and help them if they want to do it that way. So, yeah, I think what you say there will please a lot of people. But anyway, right, John, I'll hand over to you.
Okie dokie. I'll move us on to another car dealer live story, I think. I'm going to talk about our manufacturer panel. Representatives from BYD, NIO, which I believe is not yet established here, but will be soon, and Stellantis, of course, the enormous conglomerate of European and American brands, were on our stage. All three of them were critical of the government's approach to electrification, and in particular, I think they all wanted more from the budget was the fundamental thing there. So I think everyone... The line is really that they weren't expecting much, but they would have liked something, and there was just nothing in the budget for them in terms of stimulating demand. I mean, there was a lot of really interesting lines came out of that, which I won't go through entirely, but that's the nub of the story is they still want more. They need something. They believe something is needed to stimulate electric vehicle sales. And I think it's a story we hear time and time again, isn't it? I think we had largely the same story last week, to be honest, with, I think it was a Stellantis brand.
Massive.
I mean, are you surprised at that? They are
massive missed opportunity, John, wasn't it? I was listening to the, I don't know if you did, but I listened to the budget on the radio on the way up in full, which I think I've done for a long, long time. And I was waiting all the way on. He was kind of talking about the different things, childcare, and now the creative industries. And I was thinking, come on, where's automotive? Like, you know, surely we're above some of those things.
Was it going alphabetically?
Yeah, well, obviously not. No, and it got to the end, and I commend this budget to the House. And, what a missed opportunity that was. You know, and there's my last week predicting that there would definitely be something in the budget to help electric cars, and nothing.
Did I predict there wasn't?
I think you said there wasn't, and I said there would be. The
hollow victory for me there.
Yeah, I'm very, very surprised that there wasn't. And I saw some commentary online that they didn't help out electric cars because, and this was just, I think this must have been on social media. But it was someone saying they didn't help out electric cars because they didn't think it looked right helping rich people buy expensive electric cars. I mean, I can't remember who said it, but I thought, is there any truth in that? I mean, why they've kept fuel duty down. So they clearly want to help motorists in some way. They're the ones mandating this 22% target for manufacturers. It's very, very difficult out at the moment. All of the people we spoke to yesterday said it's really hard to sell new electric cars at the moment. And there we get a budget that doesn't help them in any way. I was honestly shocked there was nothing in it. What did you think, Catherine? I mean, were you surprised or were you expecting anything in the budget like I was to help the industry?
I think we'd been doing a lot of lobbying work, as you know, with the estimates. Yeah. And we share all of our data on electric vehicle car buyers with the government. And that highlights very, very clearly the challenge, which is that electric vehicles are not accessible to most car buyers because of this 40% premium that you still have with a new EV. So what the budget could and should have addressed was exactly the reverse of that social media challenge, James. It was like, well, yes, like you need to be able to afford to buy an EV today to be able to make that switch to pay that green premium. And most people can't afford that. So that's a classic moment where actually government support for a transitionary period to help meet people make that first leap. It's an absolute prime moment where the government could have played a really influential role. Basic things like standardizing the VAT on public charging, which is just actually about fairness, I think, rather than anything, rather than making some big green pledge. But the government has now made this commitment and essentially handed it to the industry and said, off you go, please make that happen. Good luck. And it feels hard. And there's some basic policy and infrastructure points that aren't there. I had very low expectations because it always felt like it was going to be an election budget, not really dealing actually with the substantial things that as a country, as an economy that we need dealt with. So I wasn't expecting huge shifts. But for the industry, it is, I would have it as the top challenge for this year, how we create and stimulate consumer demand to enable manufacturers to hit that 22% ZEV mandate. What? Because unless something fundamentally changes, like consumers are not going to be there to sustain the level of supply that's coming into the market.
On that point, Catherine, what do you think they could have done to help? I mean, is it a scrappy scheme? Is it a cut in VAT?
Was a grant on used cars, wasn't it?
Yeah. And what would get consumers interested? What would work, do you think?
I think, to be honest, we just need any catalyst to shift the dialogue, because the national press and media conversation around electric vehicles in the last 12 months has become incredibly toxic.
Yes.
Very hard to find positive stories, like affirmations for consumers to look to go, oh, there's someone I know or I admire or I respect talking positively about their EV experience. It's become a bit of a favorite, hasn't it, for media to kind of be electric vehicle bashing continuously, right at the moment where we need the conversation to be a very positive one. So any signal in the budget would have been helpful, because we just need to start changing that narrative and changing that dialogue. And there's loads of great work going on in the industry, from the charging providers, from the manufacturers, to try and change this conversation. But a signal from the government, like some of those bigger, more influential media voices being prepared to have at the moment, which seems to be a slightly controversial view, that electric vehicles might be a great driving experience. Used electric vehicles are really affordable, a great choice for many, many consumers. We need some of those headlines, some of those messages to increasingly be out there.
We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
John, can I take this on to a very similar story for my one?
I'm shocked. Two EV stories in 1 week. It's,
I know.
It happens every week.
But this is off the back of the Car Dealer Live panel with the franchise dealers and some comments from Wessex Garages boss, Chris Wiseman. He said the electric vehicle market this year, his words, could be a bloodbath. And he really does think there needs to be some assistance out there. His comments on the stage were very, very, very stark. He was mentioned, and this is a garage owner who represents a number of electric vehicle franchises: Nissan, Aura, Hyundai, all very heavily invested in electric cars. But he says that the big thing is price. He says that's a key factor. We can talk about infrastructure, he said on the stage. We can talk about home charges and costs and everything else, but it's going to be driven by the cost of entry for the consumer. He was talking about Chinese brands. He said they're well-placed to come into the UK with a very competitive pricing message. I don't think they are at the moment because they're priced into a basket of cars that currently exists here. If that model changes and they want to flick the switch and talk about volume, the danger is that the OEMs in this country will not have the margins in their cars to compete. He said, then there's the tariff situation to consider and whether that comes into play. So there could be a bloodbath this year on EVs. I think I'm inclined to agree with him. You know, if the Chinese, we had BYD there, didn't we? You've already mentioned. Huge ambitions in this country. If they suddenly decided, because those cars are priced in the UK very differently to what they are in China, if they suddenly decided, well, actually, no, we want to do what Tesla's done. We really want to start stealing some volume here, building this brand in the UK, building the used car business, building an after-sales business, they can do that by flicking that price switch. And at that point, it does get very, very difficult out there because consumers are, as we know, are going to be quite fickle. And I think, Catherine, you've done some research in the past, haven't you, into these new Chinese challenger brands? And actually, I seem to remember consumers were very interested in them. They weren't as loyal when it came to EVs as they were with traditional petrol and diesel cars. They were willing to try something different. So I think this could cause some trouble if these Chinese brands do decide to start pulling that price lever. What do you think, Catherine?
I mean, we've definitely seen and we continue to see from consumers, because it is a fundamental product shift. Consumers, when they talk about buying an electric vehicle, the product that they talk about buying is a very different product experience to buying an ICE vehicle. And because it is that technology product shift, they are more open to kind of resetting almost any brand loyalties or any brand associations they have for ICE vehicles, and being much more open-minded to a broader cohort of brands in that electric vehicle purchase journey. So we see a great opportunity actually for new entrant brands into that market. And British consumers, we are notoriously disloyal actually to either British brands or to any brand. We're much more likely to switch than consumers in other markets. So for those Chinese entrants, with our 2035 deadline and with that consumer behavior as a backdrop, I think compared to other European markets, we're an attractive place to try and build a brand and build a European presence. You're right, we haven't seen, I think as some expected, them compete particularly aggressively on price yet. So the market shares, the registration stats have all been not without growth or without some momentum, but from a very, very small base. Other than Tesla, we haven't seen anyone make really big inroads. I do agree with Chris that the new EV market this year, I'm not sure it needs to be a bloodbath, but certainly the level of discounting, we've seen double the level of, or the discount double so far this year on the averaged new electric vehicle on Autotrader. We're seeing big finance contributions from the manufacturers. That is only gaining momentum as we're pushing into the year, and we're seeing that pressure on hitting the 22%, with every month that goes past, there's going to be more and more pressure to make that happen. So for new electric vehicles, I agree there's a lot more, I think there's more pain to come for the manufacturers and for retailers with those demos or short cycle stock that will increasingly be coming through. For the used market, actually, particularly in 1 year and older electric vehicles, with the supply that we're seeing, demand is comfortably keeping up at the moment with the supply that's coming to market. And we're seeing, because we're much closer to price parity, really good propensity for consumers to make that switch. So I don't think kind of blanket EV market overall is going to be a bloodbath is necessarily what we'll see. But there's definitely going to be pockets that are very difficult for manufacturers and retailers.
I think we're going to have some amazing offers on new EVs. We're already starting to see them. I think I heard yesterday that the new Dacia Spring is going to be something like £17,000-£18,000.
I thought it was 15.
Was it really?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, that's a very cheap electric car.
That's a very cheap car in
general. Yeah, true. Yeah, true. And I think when you start seeing those sorts of offers in the market, some of these some of these new brands are really going to have to start competing. And actually, I was really impressed because we had those two BYDs there, didn't we? Either side of the stage, there was the dolphin. Is the dolphin the larger one, the white one? Yeah, and the seal, the smaller one. The dolphin is the first time I'd seen that. The large one looks like a kind of Tesla Model 3.
You've gone the wrong way around. I think the dolphin's a small one.
Is it? No. Thank you. Sorry, the seal. Okay. But yeah. Ridiculous names, but great cars. And I had a really, I had a really good look around the white one. And I was really impressed. I was really impressed in the build quality looked good. The design was really nice. And I think if that was at the right price, they'd sell a lot of them. So yeah, it's going to be interesting.
What I took away from BYD being on the panel is that they, I mean, as far as Mark Blundell from BYD is concerned, they're definitely quietly confident, aren't they? Well, I wouldn't even say it's quietly confident. He's very confident.
Yes.
You know, and all to him, really. It's I can see how they're going to do well. And I like their model as well. The interesting thing about BYD, of course, is they are going with dealers and they are quite happy to set themselves up in a corner of a of your multi-franchise site or whatever. And
or a used car site. Like or a used car site,
exactly. Yeah. They're not putting too much emphasis on corporate identity and all this sort of stuff. I think they'll do well.
Yeah,
it may well be the it may well be the year of the dragon for more than one reason. Then,
yeah,
right,
very good, very good, very good. Right, John, that was my story, I think. So it's your turn.
Okay, I'm going to dovetail this into another car dealer live story. I'm sorry.
Excellent.
But this is research from Cox Automotive.
Oh yes, I had this.
Yes, so they're predicting a lot of things, and it's if you attended the event, it's well worth downloading the white paper. If you didn't attend the event, please buy a replay ticket so you can download the white paper.
Brilliant plug. Well done.
Thank you. The headline of this for me is that diesel sales are poised to fall to 3% by 2028, which, is lower than we were expecting. I mean... Yeah. I mean, it's not high at the minute. I'm surprised how low it is right now. But 3% is a tiny, tiny amount. And one of the kind of predictions, if I can call it that, from Phil Nottard on stage is this, you know, this might have an impact on values in a positive way for diesels, because there's probably more than 3% of the market are still very attached to their diesel, be it for towing a caravan or doing ridiculous miles. You know, there are people, there are pockets of the UK that do silly amounts of miles in their cars and will probably struggle at this point even with a 400 mile EV range. So there's a possibility, if I can find something positive from this, that diesel cars will have a bit of a renaissance in values is slightly their prediction, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was amazed by it, but I mean, actually, when you look at the facts, it's quite easy to see how it's going to be shrunk to that sort of level. I mean, diesel already is, as you say, a lot smaller share of the market. And I mean, they're predicting. So this is a 4-year forecast, 24 to 27. EV share registrations are going to grow 160%, they think. They're going to go up to 2.3 million units during that time, or 28% of sales. The thing that struck me about that one, 28% sales, is quite a long way short of the ZEV mandate, isn't it, over the next few years? It's 22% this year, and I think by 2028, it's 66%. So, you know, I think they're predicting there is going to be a struggle there, which we probably suspect.
Lots of credits being exchanged, I imagine.
Yeah. BYD will be very happy.
I think it highlights, doesn't it, that there's no such thing as a UK car buyer. Like, there's lots and lots of different motivations, reasons why people want access to a vehicle. And we need an industry and a market that's prepared to meet all of those different needs. And at the moment, for some people, you know, a diesel car is still going to be the best choice. So that view that there's going to be a long tail for a very long time of diesel and electric and petrol vehicles, I think is absolutely the right one, because there's no new registrations coming to market, used cars last 15, 20 years now, that's a very, very long run out period for the UK car park. So diesel cars and vehicles and vans, they're not going anywhere anytime soon. And for many consumers, they're going to be the right choice for a long while to come yet.
Yeah, definitely. Right, I'm going to pick my last story, but I'm going to combine two, John, if that's allowed. And I'm going to talk about our two headline interviews yesterday at Car Dealer Live. And that was one with Peter Vardy and one with Peter Waddell. Firstly, just tell the Peter Waddell story. He arrived at the venue.
So you're going to say what, from Inception? Glasgow. A rainy day. 1916.
I did that on the stage. No, he arrived at the he arrived at the venue in his helicopter. We did have to find him a landing site at the British Motor Museum, and then send a Skoda Superb to pick him up and bring him to the front door. He did arrive at the venue like a king, and when he was on stage, he was his usual entertaining self. I very much enjoyed the interview. Peter Waddell is not the easiest person to interview. Because he does like to go off on many different tangents, but those tangents are always, always very interesting. But the standout line for me was his offer, his cheeky offer to Cazoo, where he went straight in as soon as he saw the news that they were looking to liquidize their stock. He offered to buy all of them. So he's they're in conversations at the moment to try and buy 3,500 used cars from Cazoo to put on the Big Motor in World website and on his sites. So yeah,
He also thanked them for their discounted transporters.
Oh, he did many times. Yeah,
he bought the first round when they got rid of quite a few of them a few months ago, didn't he? And I assume he's now after the rest of them.
Yeah, because he's done very well with those. His big once your car. He was saying he was buying 150 to 200 cars a day via Big Once Your Car, which I thought was an amazing statistic. So yeah, I really enjoyed the Peter Waddell chat, but that was the standout line. But also Peter Vardy, he started the day. There's been a lot of rumours about Peter Vardy's business over the last few weeks. And he was very open, very candid about what's been going on. I mean, my highlights from that really were the fact that he's very worried about volume sales, volume new sales, and that's why he's backed away from them. He's really struggled with the used car market, used car supermarket model. He struggled to get hold of the cars needed. He tried to start selling older cars and that didn't really work because they kept on bouncing back and had lots of problems. And he used the opportunity to sort of kind of quash a few rumours, didn't he? One of which was the guy who runs the local chip shop, who's been telling everybody he's been in the Priory. He said he hasn't been in the Priory. And the other one was that he's cloned his house and an architect is building it brick for brick in Australia. He said also that's not true. So clearly there's been a lot of the rumour mill in the Scottish motor trade has clearly been running great guns. But yes, he used the opportunity to that first headline interview to kind of put the record straight. I just thought I've got a huge amount of respect for Peter Vardy and the way he runs his business. It's obviously been a very difficult time, but he very much cares for his staff. I mean, he's always tried to look after them as best as possible. And when you have to make difficult decisions like this, you know, he is running a business. But he tries his very best to look after the people that he's got, and he explained how he's tried to do that. And actually, you could see it was difficult for him, and has been difficult over the last few weeks and months. So yeah, I huge amount of respect for both Peter Vardy and Peter Waddell, and very much enjoyed those headline interviews yesterday.
Yes, it's interesting the difference between them. I almost wanted them both on stage at once. I mean, it was the event of it might as well have been called Peter Live, our event, mightn't it? But yeah, two very different operators. I think just going back to Peter Waddell for a minute, I think I'll let's call him a divisive character. I think we've got a lot of characters in our industry, haven't we? I think you have to be very, what he's done is outstanding, like the way that he's grown that business from nothing. And it's just when we have people like that appear, I always think, not to go back to Cazoo, but the difference between something where it's come from, you know, the brainchild of a man, Alex Chesterman, who's gone, I think I can do this. Let's get a lot of investment and throw a lot of money behind it, versus someone similar to Tom Hartley, who started with nothing and has built their way up. I think the foundations of a business that have been built from nothing like that, obviously much harder and much slower to do, I think you end up with a stronger business because you are much more aware of costs. I think That's the issue with Cazoo for me, is that probably they came in wanting to expand fast. I would imagine they were not counting every single penny that they spent. Because, I mean, me, I can take this back to a bit of consumerism for you.
Oh, yes, please.
If I go and buy something, I spend about 4 hours trying to find the best price or whatever it is, telly, whatever, yada, yada, yada. If I won the lottery tomorrow, I would not bother doing that. And I think Cazoo won the lottery of investments and went out and spent big, bought all these nice, shiny, brand new lorries and transporters, painted them all up beautifully, bought personalized registration plates for every single one. And now it's very well. And Peter Bardell is buying them for half the price.
Yeah. I mean, Peter, I had a chat with Peter before we went on stage, and he was telling me about some of the new businesses he's bought. And he was very proudly showing me how he's changed one around, changed all of the branding. And he was just telling me about when he went in there, he said that they said to him, welcome, to his new site. That's your office up there. And it was this huge kind of, he said that the office was absolutely huge. He went, I don't want that office up there. He said, I want this cupboard. And it was like a broom cupboard, he said, right next to where the sales desks were. He said, clear that out, put a window in it. That's where I want to sit. And they said, really? He said, yeah, I need to be down here with the team, seeing what they're doing, hearing how the sales work, and being on the sales floor. And I think that's why Peter Waddell can make these businesses work, because he's still a grafter. He's still that used car salesman, and he wants to be in the thick of it. He wants to know what's going on. And he's not like those people that you've just mentioned, where they sort of let it run away with them. He still keeps an eye on absolutely everything. So yeah, it's a lot of respect for both of those guys.
Definitely enjoys himself as well, I would.
He certainly does. Yes,
he enjoys the fruits of his labor, I think.
He did talk about buying his son a Ferrari, who's six, and taking him to school in it. So yeah, I mean, he clearly...
Yes, and James's reply to that was, I went to school in a Mondeo.
which is true. Kathy, what did you think to those two headline interviews? I don't know if you caught them both, but I mean, they're both huge characters, aren't they?
I did. I saw them both. And you can't help but slightly be in awe of them, can you? Because they are just, I think they represent what is at the heart of this industry, which is brilliant entrepreneurs that have a point of view, have confidence in that point of view, and are prepared to go and make some really tough decisions to make big things happen. And that's what this industry needs. We need more entrepreneurs. We need more people coming into the industry, looking to the future, placing bets, taking views on what's going to happen, securing the right investment to make that happen. But at the heart of them both is a brilliant operator, isn't it? And this industry at its heart, particularly in the retail segment, is about being a brilliant operator. And yeah, both of them embody that in very different ways, don't they? But they said, so more great entrepreneurs with confidence in and conviction to make the industry and shape the industry for the future. I'd love to see, almost like the next generation of those leaders coming through. And I think some of them were there yesterday, actually.
Yeah, definitely. I love this industry for the characters. And we had lots of those on stage yesterday, that's for sure. Well, John, I'm out of stories now, so it's over to you.
I've got one more I'm going to squeeze in. Two I'm going to combine. Firstly, it's news that Jaguar are going to stop production of the XE, XF, and F-Type, which effectively means that they are SUV only now, Jaguar. So the era of the Jaguar Saloon, and somewhere James Batchelor is sobbing into a pillow, but the era of the Jaguar Saloon is over. It is entirely going to be SUVs from now on, until they perhaps introduce another one, which they haven't announced any intention of doing, because they're still a bit quite tight-lipped, aren't they, on what their future is, Jaguar. But I'm going to combine this with some data from JATO, which suggested that, well, not suggested, it stated that in January, across Europe, SUVs accounted for over half of new car registrations. And that's despite, in Europe, a little bit of an awakening in terms of anti-SUV feeling. I mean, we've seen quite a few cities do things like impose heavier parking charges for anything that's deemed an SUV or a particularly weighty vehicle. I think they set a weight limit of a certain amount for electric cars, for example. So they're trying to discourage, for whatever reason, cars shaped like SUVs, whether they're petrol, diesel or electric. But yes, over half. So, I mean, it looks like SUVs are definitely here now. It's the year of the SUV. If last year wasn't the year of the SUV already.
The stat from this is from the 19 car groups they analysed, 19 different segments, SUVs were the best-selling vehicles in 14 of them. I mean, that's a big number, isn't it? It really is.
I know. But well, I mean, if I was a car maker and SUVs were selling, what would I make?
SUV. Well, look what Ford did with the Puma and the Fiesta, and actually there's so much of it, isn't there? And I can see why, you know, I can see why that's going to just continue to proliferate in this industry. But if you drive, you know, when you drive them, they're slightly nicer to drive. I start to sort of understand.
Converted.
Well, I sort of prefer the driving position. I like the fact that you can see a bit better. I like the fact they're a bit more easier to get out of with a bad backlight I've got. And I'm probably just getting a little bit old. So, yeah, it's SUVs for me, John.
Well, Catherine, what did you make of this? Dare we ask what you drive?
I drive a 3-year-old Tesla Model 3.
There we go, not an SUV.
No, and we had so at the time I went around and test drove all the electric vehicles that were out there. I felt like I wanted to. I live in central London, and so actually there's lots of lampposts and other chargers around, and at that time a few years ago there just wasn't the choice of electric vehicles. Actually the used market wasn't really there or that mature, and the Tesla Model 3 then was, in terms of range and performance and price, was pretty compelling. I'm not sure actually. We leased it because it was new electric vehicle, didn't want to buy it outright. And it's coming up soon. And I'm not sure that we'll stick with Tesla. I think we'll go out there and look at the market again. And the great news is there's loads more choice. And as you said before, some great deals coming through on new electric cars. So I'm actually quite excited to get back out there again and have a look at what's going to be best for us.
So you're going to go electric again?
Yeah.
And so if anybody's listening and wants to sell Catherine a car, they can find her at Auto Trader.
I'm surprised you're not trying, James, but I mean, perhaps.
Yeah. It would be a 10-year-old Nissan Leaf, and I can't see that Catherine would be interested in one of those.
In all seriousness, though, I have found, as someone that, like, I love cars, but I'm not hugely passionate about different makes or different models. It's just really fun and really easy to drive. It's really quiet, it's really peaceful. My kids love it because it's got like lights and gadgets and things that they love playing with. So it's just been a really easy, brilliant car for us to have for the last few years. So if you're not obsessed with engines and speed and all those other things, they're just really good, easy cars to own and use.
Can you charge it at home, or do you use public charging?
So we have to use public charging because we don't have a driveway or garage or anything. So we're not allowed to put, this is one of the big problems, like you're not allowed to put a charging cable over the pavement. The local council won't let you do it. So I've been fascinated by some of the startups where you can,
you can go up and over things. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think look great. And I love the innovation that's coming in that space. But yeah, we sort of dodge with our neighbours to see who can charge on the lamppost. And as you get more and more EVs, it gets harder and harder to find that infrastructure. But when we first got it 2 or 3 years ago, it wasn't a problem at all.
Wow. And you've managed that for 3 years. I mean, that really is impressive to be able to just rely on public charging, because it's not, as we know, it's not easy in some places. But I suppose, do you fast charge it at all on the Tesla network? Is that how right?
Yeah, and I think it's the biggest leap, actually, not just the product and technology shift when you're buying an electric vehicle, but you have to rewire how you think about how you use your car. So you can't just grab your keys, jump in the car and stop anywhere you like to refuel. So you do have to think, like, the night before you pop out, you like plug it in, find the lamppost that's free that evening. But actually, I never liked going to petrol stations, like the smell, it's not a nice experience. So spending 10 minutes the night before plugging in, charging, I find it's an okay trade-off compared to stopping for 10 minutes at a petrol station. And when we go on longer journeys, we just plan the route beforehand and we'll find, I don't know, somewhere with a kids play area or somewhere with nice food, and we'll stop and you make an experience of that charging moment. And you just have to rewire how you think about your car experience and the journeys you're going to go on. But I've found it's not a big change. And once you've made it, actually, you're then in that mindset. So almost switching back would feel strange.
Yeah, I'm pleased to hear you say that, because as someone that had an electric car we do have an electric car in the house, but as someone that had from a manufacturer for a year an electric car to drive around in, I rewired my brain for that. And then to be handed a petrol one was sort of a bit disconcerting afterwards. And, you know, people in our company, as we're, you know, handed for evaluation cars for a year or 6 months or whatever that are electric, it's always quite sadistically quite amusing to see them trying to adapt. And I'm thinking of poor Dave Brown trying to plug his Nissan in yesterday at the our conference venue. It's quite amusing to see the kind of like see people having to adapt their brains to the idea that, you know, you want to break, you know, build in a little stop. And I never found it a massive problem, because I sort of just thought, right, well, that's good. I can plug it in there for half an hour and have a little break on my long journey. James might disagree. But anyway, I think I better move us on to...
No comment.
Yeah. So, Catherine, are there any stories you think we've missed this week?
I mean, it's been a big week, right? Between the budget, the kazoo news, the electric vehicle debate, which feels like it's raging more than ever. We haven't talked about pricing and for retailers, for our partners that we spend our time with, that is still absolutely a big, big topic of conversation and a big worry for some. That would be, and I know you've covered it a bit this week, and certainly when we're talking to retailers, the level of noise around what's happening now and what might happen later this year is still a very big topic of conversation.
Yeah, definitely. One that will rumble on and we will cover at length, I'm sure, in the podcast and on the website in the future.
Absolutely. So I'm going to have to ask you, what was your favourite story? Who do you think has won?
So I'm feeling very energised and inspired about the industry from yesterday. So I would have to say the story about the two headliners from yesterday, not actually because of them as individuals, but just because the entrepreneurial spirit, the confidence, that commitment to the future, it's that I want to hang on to. And we need to inspire the next generation of those entrepreneurs, of those leaders for our industry. So I'm going to ride that wave from yesterday and pick that story.
Excellent, because that was mine. Thank you so much. I very, very much appreciate it. And we'll take the win, because it means that I'm not so far behind John once again.
Very well deserved, James. I mean, you were up on that stage for a very long time yesterday, as was James Batchelor. So well done to you for that. I wouldn't have wanted to do that.
I might have an afternoon nap to celebrate.
Yes, I think we're all energized spiritually, physically less so. Well, all that's left for me to say then is thank you to Catherine for judging today. It's been lovely to have you on, and thank you for putting up with 2 days of James asking questions to you.
Very welcome. It was an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much. Lovely to see you.
Likewise. And thank you as well to James for managing to keep talking for another hour, which is impressive, I feel.
I'm going to have my last locket now.
Oh, very good. Don't overdose on them. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, take a look in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Thanks for listening and goodbye.